Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is freight planning, impacts on air quality and greenhouse gas emissions. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presenters: Anthony Erb of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, who is filling in for Cheryl Bynum, who is no longer able to present today; Greg Natto of the Maine Department of Transportation; and Sarah Flagg of the Port of Seattle. Anthony Erb has worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for over 25 years. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Conservation and Resource Development and a Master's degree in Engineering Management. Over the years, his work at EPA has involved the development and implementation of numerous air pollution control programs related to emissions from mobile sources. He currently works in the Smartway Transport Partnership, focusing on technology performance matters related to fuel efficiency and emission reduction in the freight transportation industry, and is the primary lead for the rail sector. Greg Natto is the Maine DOT Deputy Commissioner for Policy, Planning, and Communications. He serves as a member of the Maine House of Representatives from 1978 to 1990 and served as Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Angus King of Maine from 1995 to 2002. He joined the Maine DOT in 2002 and was named Deputy Commissioner in 2003 under Governor John Baldacci's administration. He served as Governor King's liaison with the New England Governors Eastern Canadian Premiers Conference and continued that role under Governor Baldacci. He currently serves as co-chair of the NEG ECP's Transportation and Air Quality Standing Committee and serves on the AASHTO Authorization Steering Committee, the Finance and Funding Legislative Team, and is chair of its Freight Modal Funding Subgroup. Sarah Flagg is an environmental management specialist with the Port of Seattle Seaport Environmental Programs, where she specializes in air quality and sustainability. Sarah holds a BA in Environmental Planning and Policy from Western Washington University and an MA in Policy Studies from the University of Washington. This fall, she'll begin an MBA in Sustainable Business at Bainbridge Graduate Institute. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the lower right side of your screen. Please make sure you are typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and a great forum for the distribution of information, as well as a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I'd like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We're also starting something new, starting with last month's seminar, where we're recording podcasts of the webinars, and those will be posted to the website as well. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend the seminar to access the recording or the podcasts. The PowerPoint presentations used during today's seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within next week. I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript of the seminar. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is freight planning, impacts on air quality and greenhouse gas emissions. Our first presentation will be given by Anthony Erb of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. So with that, Anthony, I'm going to bring up your presentation, and you can get started.
Oh, thank you very much, Jennifer. As Jennifer said, I'm going to be sitting in for Cheryl Bynum today and making the presentation that Cheryl actually prepared. I'm going to start out with some background information that we have on greenhouse gases and emission contributions that come from the transportation sector, and then talk about EPA's efforts to reduce these contributions. And as soon as the presentation comes up, I'll get started.
It should be up on your screen now.
I still have the green thing. The green welcome freight.
Okay. Hang on 1 second. Sarah or Greg, are you seeing Anthony's presentation up?
I am seeing his presentation, Greg.
Okay. Anthony, do you have a copy of the presentation in front of you?
Yes.
If you want to just start going, so I'm not sure why the green one's still going, and if you want to tell me when to click to the next slide, I can do that for you.
Okay. We'll start out with the slide on greenhouse gas emissions inventory, with I think is slide 2, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if we go to that, just provides basic information on greenhouse gas inventory for the U.S., and we're looking at our contributions being 7,261 million metric tons. Of that, roughly 28% or 2,014 million metric tons are coming from the transportation sector, which is what I'm primarily going to focus on today. So the left-hand pie chart shows that. And then the right-hand table shows essentially the sources within the within the transportation sector and where the greenhouse gases are coming from. And as you can see, roughly 59.5% are coming from light-duty trucks and passenger cars. And we also have a significant contribution from freight trucks of 19%. So what we're seeing from the transportation sector is primarily from either light duty or the freight trucks or passenger cars. And right today, I'm mainly going to focus on what we're seeing from the freight trucks. And Jennifer, if you could move the slide, I guess.
Sure. Are you, one question, are you in full screen mode?
Yeah, that's from.
That might be, someone suggested if you turn that off that you could see it. I'm not sure why it's doing that, but...
I'm still seeing the welcome to the freight planning.
Even after you turned off the full screen mode.
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. I'm just seeing if I could fix this here. Oh, I think I figured out what was wrong.
Hopefully it wasn't something I did.
No, I think I got it. Are you seeing it now?
Yeah, I'm in it now, and I guess I could go back to full screen. Is that possible?
I believe it should be okay.
All right.
Actually...
I can work with this, I think.
I'm going to take it off the mode that you just had on because that brought up another way for me to see. So maybe if you just leave it like it is right now, that might be best.
Okay. So we'll move on to the next slide. And this is the regulatory efforts EPA is undertaking in the highway heavy-duty diesel emission standards. And as you can see... I don't know if this pointer is showing up on your screen or not. Let me do this one. Back in 1990, we were at PM of 0.60 grams per brake horsepower hour and NOx at 6 grams per brake horsepower hour. And if we go all the way down to what we're proposing for 2010, which will originally start in 2007, we'll plan to get our PM levels for new engines down to 0.01 grams per brake horsepower hour for PM, and NOx will be at 0.20. So the standards have ratcheted down significantly in terms of the regulatory requirements for new emission standards, but you know, what we're going to see is that over time, you know, these diesel engines last a long time, so that's why we've implemented some voluntary programs that will also focus on reducing these emissions. And this is another issue we have in terms of highway vehicle miles traveled. If we look at the 1950, we were down at 500,000,000 miles traveled on our highways. And going to 2000, we are up to 3 trillion miles. So the increase there is significant, to say the least. And also, ton miles of freight, if we go to 1980 compared to 2001, we have significantly increased there as well, from freight ton miles going from 100 ton miles, I'm sorry, not 100 ton miles, but it's doubled essentially over the over this period of time. Now, the voluntary aspects of what EPA is doing to focus on this is we have formed a number of clean diesel partnerships, marine ports, construction, school buses, the freight aspects, as well as agriculture. So each one of these programs is set up to provide for voluntary adoption of technologies that reduce emissions of both CO2 and the primary pollutants that we're concerned with. And the goal of all these programs is essentially reduce emissions from the 11 million engines that are in use out there. And you can see the various logos we have for the Smartway Transport Partnership, Clean Ports USA, as well as the school bus program. And I'm going to really focus on Smartway a little bit. The other programs have similar aspects to them to what we have here in Smartway. But just to give you an idea, that Smartway is basically set up to provide the cleanest and most efficient transportation options for the freight industry. And we have a website here for passenger vehicles if somebody's interested in finding out which passenger vehicles are going to be the cleanest and most efficient. There's a website we have set up for commercial vehicles, Smartway Class 8 tractors and trailers. We have a designation as a Smartway tractor trailer, and that basically is the best of the best that the companies can provide. And basically, as far as our partnership goes, when Smartway Transport partnership is joined, there's a commitment to conserve fuel and reduce emissions in the transport sector by the partners that join, and especially the carriers we're looking at. A little bit of background is that Smartway is free to join. Companies of any size can join. We have some that only have one truck, and we have some that have thousands of trucks. Smartway companies join and commit to improve fuel efficiency over a three-year period, and shipping companies are joining as well. So it's anyone that ships goods would commit to ship 50% or more of their product with Smartway designated trucking partners, and also to improve over a three-year period. So that's essentially what we're trying to do with the Smartway program, is to reduce emissions from the freight industry voluntarily. And what we're finding is that as the price of fuel goes up, it's a much easier sell. It was an easy sell in the beginning because for once somebody was coming to these folks and from the government, and rather than setting up programs that were costing them money, we were setting up a program that was going to save them money, and so the buy-in was pretty quick. We also try to accelerate the technology implementation into the fields, and the way we do that is, provide information to the industry via the web and industry events that shows the advantages of these technologies, and also shipper relationships to reward high-performing fleets. A shipper can look on our website and get an idea of how well each company performs. So if they want to go with the most efficient company to reduce their environmental footprint, they're able to go to our website and actually select the ones with the highest scores. And so therefore, in their shipping mode, they're as efficient as they can be. We've also promoted some dealer networks so that folks can get get equipment easily, find sources for this equipment. And on the funding side, there's some DERA funding that we've accessed for innovative emission reduction technologies. And these are all included in the websites that we've set up under each one of our sectors. And we've just recently expanded access to capital via a Smartway Finance Center, which is a pretty slick option, and I'll discuss that in a little bit. Benefits for the partners, I talked about this a little bit. Better info about their transportation footprint, you know, and if they try to reduce it. And we're finding a lot of companies are in the green mode and want to go as far as they can with this. And they demonstrate corporate citizenship by hiring the environmentally minded carriers. And that's important for us because somebody that's in Smartway, you know, they'll have more business directed towards them, so there'll be more use of them. And overall, the environment is the benefit of that. And for the carriers, it's pretty straightforward that, you know, if they're going to use less fuel, they're going to save money. And we provide a method for them to track fuel consumption as well as emissions, and they can do a cost-benefit analysis on our website as well. And this says rail and truck fleet, so we have, you know, basically the programs we've set up are going to apply to rail as well. We're a little bit farther behind on the rail than we are in the truck fleet sector, but we're picking up speed there. And we have affiliates. They would be companies that want to promote Smartway. We have access. They provide them with access to tools for marketing and outreach, and the truck stops, you know, that are set up for no idling zones, et cetera. There's some promotion for them as well. And, you know, we do recognize them in the public sector for providing this information. I talked a little bit about this. It's our Freight Logistics and Environmental Energy Tracking Fleet Model. This is a way for a company to look at what they're doing with their fleet and calculate their CO2, NOx, and PM. And they can look at the effectiveness of strategies and how that affects essentially their footprint. And they can estimate cost savings here as well. And shippers can track the percentage of freight that they're shipping with Smartway partners, as well as measure their environmental footprint based on how, you know, how they select partners that are the best of the best, essentially. Benefits for the environment, I think most folks are familiar with these. You know, health impacts are lessened, the air quality is improved, and our vulnerable populations, you know, the children, the elderly, with existing health conditions that are most affected by the pollution, it lessens the impacts on them as well. And an interesting fact is, you know, every gallon of gasoline is going to produce 22.2 pounds of CO2. So in terms of global warming and climate change, there's significant impact there. And last but not least, to improve our energy security, fuel prices we've all seen have gone up dramatically here in the last few months, and the availability of fuel. We still have it available, but we're paying a high price at this point. But I guess some point in the future, availability is going to be more of an issue. Right now, Smartway has 882 partners, and this is the list of the folks that we have included. Fuel saved, on the right column, you'll see the gallons of fuel we project to save a year. Currently, based on our commitments, CO2 is basically a reflection of that fuel. And then the NOx savings, as well as the PM reduced on a per year basis from the commitments we have. So we're on the path to what our goals are in Smartway, but, you know, we've got farther to go for sure. So each year we're doing our best to improve that. Types of shipper strategies. Obviously, looking at intermodal shipments and rail shipments is going to save quite a bit of fuel based on the efficiency of the rail sector. shipping them with full truckloads, and then idle reduction policies at loading facilities can significantly reduce the fuel that's burned. And more you're seeing no idling zones set up in various aspects of the transportation sector. These are types of carrier strategies for trucks and locomotives where, you know, idle reduction, you know, you can put on an auxiliary power unit to provide heating and cooling. You can put on a heating unit that'll provide you essentially heating in the winter time. We have improved aerodynamics for tractors and trailers, low rolling resistance tires, speed management, and I won't go through the list completely, but you know, all the way down to hybrid technology. So these are all strategies that are being promoted within the SmartWay sector, and essentially you can make significant reductions in your fuel use. And somebody that's using a number of these strategies, you know, the 10% to 20% and fuel consumption reduction would be possible. SmartWay technology program, we've done some testing, and we're looking at modeling to quantify technologies. We've actually got some SAE papers out there on some testings we did with low rolling resistance tires and aerodynamic fairings. They're all on, available through our website. We've also done one on idling reduction equipment, which we're also in the future, not too distant future, will be setting up a testing program that will evaluate, give the manufacturers the opportunity to evaluate their individual products with a program we're setting up with Texas. And emission control technologies, the voluntary diesel retrofit program has been around for a while, and they're evaluating these control technologies because a lot of times folks will come up with something that, you know, they've got a lot of testimonials on, but the idea behind the test protocols we have for evaluation of technologies actually provides a level playing field to really get the results that you need to judge these technologies. And then we have SmartWay tractors and trailers that are designated based on the way they're built and the engines that are in them, as well as their aerodynamics that can be qualified. And we have evaluated, not them completely, but we're going to be setting up a test program to do that as well in the not-too-distant future, probably starting this summer. Reducing unnecessarily truck idling and rail idling. We've essentially got a paper out there that provides guidance for states to implement idle reduction projects. And sort of a model state idle reduction law to provide consistency across the states, because, you know, if one of these guys is going from one site to the next, it'd be nice if the law is the same versus you know, different aspects of it would just be too hard to follow for one individual trucker going through all 50 states. So we provided that, and I think in general that's the guideline most states are using. And funding for truck stop electrifications and auxiliary power unit installations. You know, we've issued some grants out there, and we have 86 projects nationwide that are currently underway. This is something we provide to show that technology pays for itself. It's very very simple. We have a calculator tool on our website that would help folks out with that. But as you can see, that on a monthly basis, buying this technology actually saves these guys money. Now our finance center, we've set this up. You can't really read this, but essentially it's a simple process for somebody to obtain a loan. We were finding that, you know, we had the information out there on the technologies, but actually trying to find financing for these folks sometimes was difficult, so that was standing in the way of implementing it. So we recently spent some time and set up a finance website to do this. We have other opportunities for financing as well that we've promoted in the past. There's various lenders out there, and we try to provide information to give the freight companies the opportunity to have easier access to this financing if it's an issue. We have a SmartWay truck. I talked about that, a tractor and trailer. And essentially, it's got to be the latest, greatest, 2000 with the diesel particulate filter, idle reduction, low rolling resistance tires, and again, 10 to 20% fuel savings is what we'd be featuring here. And we do provide information on our website on which trucks are available there. Promotion, we have a number of publications out there in various magazines. And we're just going to start over a new SmartWay Lead program, which hopefully you'll be seeing on the TV to, again, to promote SmartWay. But these are tractor makers that are bought into the SmartWay program, as well as trailer manufacturers. And we did a review of how their specification, how they're built, essentially, to make sure that they're going to qualify as SmartWay trucks. And so far, we've had good response from them. And, you know, not every truck's going to be a SmartWay truck, and the manufacturers understand that. Again, this is EPA's website for passenger vehicles. Check out the Green Guide, SmartWay Elite, two different classifications, and SmartWay, different categories that folks can look at as far as being efficient and having low emissions. Believe it or not, we're going to have a SmartWay NASCAR out there, which is should be pretty neat. We had a Trick My Truck show. Episode, the fellows, there's a Chrome Shop Mafia on the internet, or not the internet, but the whatever that's called, the TV shows, that cable TV essentially, it's there. And they did produce a SmartWay truck and, you know, retrofit an older truck with SmartWay components, and that was well received. And, you know, we have our website that provides all the information on what we're doing with SmartWay. PFA campaign, you'll see a number of these out there. The rail folks are getting more active as well. Truck haulers are more active, and we're trying to do the best we can to get the word out on the SmartWay program. ATA, the American Trucking Association, announced an initiative in May 8, 2008, and number of goals they've set out, but they're putting up some big numbers as far as what they would like to do over the next 10 years. One of their recommendations is that, to join SmartWay, and we were pretty pleased to see that. And again, there's a website here for more information on that. Getting close to the end, we're talking about greening the supply chain. Again, it's intermodal use of rail. And in the next slide, we'll go into a little more detail about everything that's essentially in a SmartWay supply chain model concept that people would be able to track their emissions all the way through. We start at, you know, we have the port, border trucks, air travel, all the various aspects of how goods can be transported from one place to the next. And we want to get the entire footprint so somebody would be able to evaluate how efficient they're being in all modes of their transportation. And we have after 4 years, SmartWay and our 882 partners committed to save, you know, significant numbers of fuel. We're looking at tons of CO2 and NOx and PM as well. And we have some goals in SmartWay, expand the shipper supply chain models and tools. We're working on this currently. And streamline carrier tools so it's easier for them to figure out, you know, how effective they're being. The test protocol we've established for trucks, we have a draft out there that will look at the efficiency of various drugs and provide a way to evaluate technologies, again, in a level playing field, and launch a new PSA that is going to promote Smart Way. And, you know, essentially collaborative with stakeholders to evolve Smart Way in ways that add the most value to our partners, trucking companies, shippers, states, and the general public. So, again, I'm Anthony Erb, and I'm presenting this for Cheryl. Her information's there, and I can give my information over the phone if that's useful to folks, but I'm at 202-343-9259, and my email is very close to Cheryl's. It's just Erb, E-R-B, dot Anthony, at EPA.gov. And I think that's the end of the presentation for me, and, you know, we can have some questions at the end as far as folks go.
Great. Thank you, Anthony. Yeah, we do have some questions typed in there, and we'll get to those after the other presentations. We'll move on to our next presentation now. It's going to be given by Greg Natto of the Maine Department of Transportation. So, Greg, whenever you're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Anna. Appreciate the invitation to be here. I'm going to discuss today sort of a policy overview, if you will, with regard to freight issues, both regional, state, and national. And I've actually been presenting a talk really principally around the New England Northeast region to rail and shipper groups. So the emphasis, for the most part, is sort of rail-oriented, but I'll expand on that in a minute. But basically, the theme of the talk has been the transportation trifecta, and it's the linkage of global competitiveness, highway and bridge preservation, and clean air. And I don't know how that got in there, but actually I do. I don't miss an opportunity to remind people that Maine is in New England, and New England are Red Sox fans. My apologies to you Yankee fans. I actually meant to replace this with a Boston Celtics logo in celebration of our great victory last night. But I'll move on. The transportation trifecta. For each dollar invested in improving the efficiency of freight transportation, you impact the global competitiveness of those industries and businesses that depend on transportation to be competitive. We have the significant potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as was just discussed at length, the impact of greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 on climate change, and shifting significant amount of freight off of our highway and bridges onto options like freight rail or marine options will lead to improving the condition of our highways and bridges, and given the constraints on DOTs to fund the highway and bridge system, that's going to become more and more important. With respect to global competitiveness, our competitors, China as the biggest and principal example, 10.5% of their annual GDP growth is devoted to transportation through 2002-2006. China will invest 9%, that's their annual growth rate between those years, 2002-2006. Of that growth, they're planning on investing 9% of their total GDP for new infrastructure through 2011. Four of the top 10 container ports in the world are in China. 52,000-mile National Expressway system is going to be complete in about, I think, by 2020. That 41% number is actually higher now. They're planning 18 major intermodal rail yards for construction in that period as well, and they're well underway. With respect to air quality, climate change will be a central policy focus in the next Federal Transportation Reauthorization Act in 2009. I think that evidence already exists. California and the northeastern states are really leading the nation in policy development to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the energy and transportation sectors, and I'll talk a little bit about how we're participating in that a bit later. With respect to highway and bridge preservation, one freight car equals four trucks on our highways and bridges. Approximately 85% of all freight tonnage is moved by trucks in Maine, down from 89% in 2000. And I'll talk a little bit about how we've managed to ratchet that percentage down over the years. Maine alone is looking at a shortfall of $3 billion just to adequately maintain our current highway and bridge infrastructure and invest in basic strategic investments over the next 10 years. That does not include a lot of new capacity. According to Federal Highway, or it may be Federal Highway, the National Revenue Commission, ASHTO, there are a number of groups projecting at least a doubling of freight over the next 20 years. We've got to get more freight off the roads and onto rail or marine options. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure when it comes to preserving our highway and bridge system. What's driving this? Something I call the forces of nature. According to the ASHTO Freight Bottom Line Report, we talked about the growth that everyone is projecting of freight over the next 20 years. Well, there are four major drivers that they discussed with respect to this, what's driving this freight demand. First, consumption. The U.S. population reached 300 million in 2006 and will reach 380 million by 2035. This population growth will drive more demand for goods, driving the demand for more freight transportation. The second is production. The growth in service employment will outpace manufacturing employment, but investment in technology and improvements in manufacturing processes will increase manufacturing output and generate demand for freight transportation. These are sort of fundamental economic principles. The third is international trade. Trade grew very slowly between the 80s and 1960s, but if you look at recent trends as a percent of GDP, we've reached 27% in 2005 and it's projected to go to 37% by 2015. As you can see, 60% by 2030. So this is clearly going to intensify the flow of goods through our international gateways and around the country and employ a tremendous amount of pressure on our transportation system. The fourth is supply chain management. Most businesses have moved or are moving to pull or on-demand supply chains. So that basically has converted our transportation system to a system of rolling warehouses. It's good for business. It reduces their cost of to hold inventory, but it has increased tremendously the pressure on the transportation system. Rail is becoming increasingly important in the in addressing the kind of pressure that this increased freight movement and goods movement is going to have on our national system, but it sorely needs some attention. I want to use an example of what we're doing in Maine to, if you will, take advantage of the capacity that exists on the rail system. A consequence of the birth of the interstate system 50 plus years ago now was the demise of much of our freight system, much of our freight rail infrastructure. So 50 years later, we find ourselves in a position of having to rebuild a lot of that infrastructure we lost over the years, because one of the mobility solutions, particularly in the congested Northeast and elsewhere in the country, is to try and exploit capacity that is underutilized to solve some of our congestion issues on our major, particularly in the interstate system in our major mega regions and metropolitan areas. So what we've done in Maine, we've got a program called the Freight Rail Improvement Program. It's relatively new, and our first project was something called Danville Junction, and it's a $5 million joint investment between two of our regional railroads, in this case the Pan Am Railways and the St. Lawrence and Atlantic. Basically, the interline rail traffic between these two railroads is interchanged at this point and grew 68% in 4 years, from 14,000 over 14,000 carloads in 2002 to 21,000 carloads in 2005. Now, you can tell by the dates that was before the big spike in energy costs and fuel costs. As I think was referred to earlier, that increased fuel costs is obviously going to be driving shippers to find less expensive alternative methods of moving their freight to market or bringing their raw material in. And obviously, freight rail is the system that exists today and where the capacity often exists today. In this particular case, increased traffic has resulted in increased public wait time at grade crossings. Many of these systems exist in populated areas. It was bringing about increased noise and air pollution and increased transit time for main shippers because of the bottleneck. So this project will realign the interchange to allow these railroads to eliminate at-grade crossings of the two main lines and just make the mobility in that particular area not only easier for the local residents impacted by the switching, but easier for the railroads to put their trains together. The outcome basically is reduced public wait time and increased safety, reduced noise and air pollution, and more importantly for the economy, reduced transit time for shippers of up to 2 days, which is big money if you're moving a truck or train load of paper. And Maine is still has a significant paper industry that we depend on as an economic engine. Another program we have is called the Industrial Rail Access Program, IRAP. We basically put up 50% of an investment that is typically less than $500,000 to the shippers who want to reconnect to rail. And oftentimes we're providing a grant to the railroad because their investment has a direct correlation to connecting a shipper back to rail or enhancing their efficiency of the utilization of rail. It's all designed to incent shippers to do everything they possibly can on rail. I call it freight appropriate rail, because not all freight is appropriate for rail. It just doesn't work. The freight that doesn't have to be on the road shouldn't be on the road. That's kind of our operating philosophy. So this basic, this program, essentially our criteria are, do you remove trucks from the road, and do you have a job impact? And that's kind of, and when we score these the requests on a competitive basis, that's the criteria that matters the most, and that's what achieves the highest score and gets the grant. So every dollar we spend of public money in that program, we leverage a dollar private investment. So using those two innovative programs, we think, as an example, who can make this kind of innovation, this kind of investment happen? It's state governments, it's the federal government. In our case, the Canadian federal government and provinces. We have extensive relationships and joint ventures, given our location, with these border provinces, which will be more relevant when I get to the second half of my presentation. But mainly because the freight system is so dependent on private operators and private corporate owners, we have to establish significant partnerships with railroads and shippers and retailers and manufacturers and the entire supply chain, because much of the alternative freight transportation is privately owned, and unlike much of the rest of the transportation system, we don't have, as state DOTs or public transportation agencies, the same level of control that we would otherwise. With respect to the federal government, it's a new mindset, and this is a conversation I often have with my private sector friends, who, in answer to the question, what can government do to help you get more freight moving in a more efficient manner, the typical traditional answer has been to get out of their way. Well, we don't need the federal government in this case to get out of the way. We need them to get on board. The federal government's funding for rail and intermodalism is anemic at best, and we really need the federal government and the next Authorization Act to become full partners with the states and the private sector in the business of moving goods in this country. And if you hear the conversation associated with, in preparation for the next Authorization Act discussion, both with respect to federal agencies, the Congress, and organizations like AASHTO, clearly freight and the challenge of how we move it more efficiently is achieving a much higher standing in the next authorization debate. And speaking of federal authorization, Safety Lou expires in 2009. Congress, as we speak, is immediately working to determine how to cure the projected $3.2 billion shortfall projected in the next federal fiscal year, in the form of the Baucus-Grassley amendment that's pending. So we have an immediate immediate funding crisis at our doorstep. The next Transportation Funding Act needs to address really the long-term funding crisis. The current method of funding transportation in this country, principally the gas tax, simply isn't sustainable. And part of the National Revenue Commission and AASHTO's principles calls for the development in the nearer term than we thought, really a new method of funding transportation investment in this country. And as I said before, and I will reiterate, climate change policy is going to be a significant influence in that conversation with respect to how we fund transportation and what we fund. Freight rail, as I said, and obviously there's a heavy emphasis on freight rail, but when I say freight rail, I do not discount the possibility of marine options. The marine highway is also an area where there is potential capacity to be utilized to relieve the stress on the highway and bridge system. One other example of more regional cooperation driven by states, and in this case provinces, is the work of the New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers Conference. The following states and provinces listed on the screen are the principal participants. It's essentially Eastern Canada and the New England states. The New England Governors Conference has been around for about 31 years, has a long history of collaboration on regional issues with a particular emphasis on environmental issues. Really focuses on issues that don't recognize borders like air quality, environment, and transportation. There's a significant cross-border dependency on moving our people and our goods efficiently, and obviously air pollution doesn't recognize borders. Reduction in greenhouse gas emissions has been a particular focus and priority of the governors and premiers since they adopted their climate change action plan in 2001, and most of the member states and provinces have adopted those goals. At the 31st conference of the New England Governors, East Canadian Premiers, at Prince William Island, Canada, in June of 2007, they received a report from a ministerial forum on energy and environment that was held in Quebec earlier that year. And in preparation for that forum, there was a session entitled Transportation Solutions to Climate Change held back in Portland, Maine, actually, in 2006. So there's been a sort of a long lead to the development of these greenhouse gas emission, climate change, relationship to transportation kind of dialogue that began really significantly before the more recent emphasis on the energy crisis. So there's been a good groundwork that has been laid for what has become really one of the premier issues of our time. They adopted the recommendations of the forum, which included the creation of a new standing committee on transportation air quality, which I co-chair because my governor is the current chair of the New England Governors Conference for this year and next year. The committee was charged by the governors and premiers to implement specific action items included in the forum recommendations. Action steps included the development of these goals and objectives. The principal goals and objectives are to reduce air emissions. There's an initiative entitled the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, REGGIE for short. It's actually going to be the first cap and trade market for CO2 in the country, and it goes online on September 10th with the principal market, actually the only market, initially being the electric generation sector. They also set regional goals for greenhouse gas reductions from the transportation sector, which our committee has been charged to develop a strategy to achieve, and develop regional transportation action plan, which we are in the final throes of doing and will be presenting to them in September. The specific action steps that they've directed us to prepare strategies for are, one, the development of environmentally friendly biofuels, low carbon fuel standards to meet the targets that have been set, which I think you're probably all somewhat familiar with. It's become a fairly full policy discussion around the country, particularly in light of the Boxer Lieberman-Warner bill debate in Congress. Two, promotion of fuel efficiency in all modes of transportation, and obviously investing in the use of incentives for public to acquire fuel-efficient vehicles, like FEBA programs, utilize fuel-efficient and greenhouse gas-friendly vehicles in our public transportation fleets, which governors and premiers have some ability to directly influence, at least in the fleets that their own jurisdictions control. Three, expansion of alternative transportation and commuter services, the extent to which we can look at our systems regionally and improve their efficiency, connectivity, and really their synergies to incent more people to use them, which will have a regional benefit to all of the participants or the jurisdictions. And in doing so, figure out if there are any innovative ways to deal with funding issues. Four, alignment of our infrastructure funding with energy and climate goals by encouraging energy-efficient development in municipalities and regional entities. Probably the more difficult in that most of these decisions are driven locally, but nevertheless, in the area of funding and the policies associated with that funding, smart growth strategies can be built into some of our programmatic outlines, if you will. But that's obviously politically challenging at times, but nevertheless, it's really a function of ensuring that those dollars that the federal and state governments are investing are lasting and having a long-term return on an investment. So smart growth strategies are going to become fairly directly related to the provision of resources to achieve certain transportation goals. At least that's a significant conversation that will be going on in the context of the next Authorization Act. Five, just use of life cycle greenhouse gas carbon emission analysis to set these indicators for policy and project planning. Not always appropriate, but it's a tool that will become more and more necessary as we determine the parameters of certain types of transportation investments in the context of climate change policies that are on the horizon. And six, the governors and premiers will seek to adopt the clean car programs, California low emission vehicle programs, the types of things that are pending litigation between California and the federal government and most of the Northeast states have joined California. Basically, they pursue the adoption of CAFE standards that were higher or more aggressive than the Federal Energy Act, and that is pending, again, litigation between the EPA and the state of California and a number of northeastern states. So, but most of New England, actually most of the northeast states, have adopted what's known as CALEV, and a number of eastern Canadian provinces are considering essentially adopting the same standards. Seven, what I talked about earlier, collaboration with the private sector to seek these new opportunities to enhance regional interconnectivity and efficiency of freight networks in the region. Now, obviously, rail is principal among them because it will do Maine no good to have a gold-plated rail system from one end of the state to the other. Most of our shippers are trying to get their goods to markets in the Midwest, to the Mid-Atlantic states, or abroad. So they're trying to get them to major port facilities or intermodal facilities. So it's necessary in order to attract more shippers to the alternative systems, they're going to have to their confidence is going to have to grow in the reliability and the efficiency of those systems. So it's critical that we look at them from a regional and really national perspective to ensure that the connectivity of those systems is as efficient as it could possibly be. In that way, no doubt the market will dictate the more competitive option in terms of price. One particular shipper I was speaking to the other day was looking at moving a shipment of paper. The difference in truck rates versus rail, it was $230 a ton versus $80. So the market will certainly be attractive enough. Nevertheless, from a price standpoint, nevertheless, that shipper has to ensure that their product is getting to their customer on time. It's not worth it for them to save $160 a ton if they don't have that confidence because they've got to keep their customer. That's where the that's where the government and the private sector can really join to ensure that those efficiencies can be built into the system, because the private sector simply won't be able to do it by themselves. The resources aren't there. In closing, I'll just touch on much of what I've talked about in sort of a regional sense. Working closely with AASHTO on their authorization policy process, and obviously AASHTO represents the DOTs across the country, and specifically been working on this freight funding modal team. One of the issues that we're grappling with is this challenge that currently and historically there's been relatively anemic funding for freight-related system investment from the government side, if you will. It's been principally a privately held, privately funded system. So in order to accelerate the development of the efficiencies I've talked about, more money has got to be raised really outside the Highway Trust Fund. Given that the Highway Trust Fund is currently unable to meet the obligations of the current system to any great extent, and dealing with those challenges is going to be tough enough. So AASHTO is working with a number of freight stakeholders, you know, sort of identified in this slide, from a number of sectors in the economy, to try and work with them to build a consensus around potential new sources of funding that would accrue outside the Highway Trust Fund and be available to invest in the freight distribution system. There's a number of proposals emanating from these other organizations dealing with specific elements of that system, whether it's highway related or freight rail related, or with respect to our waterways. We surveyed all of these organizations. AASHTO did. And questions like, do you think that the freight industry in general would be willing to support new sources of revenue? New sources of revenue that have been mentioned include things like custom fees and waybill taxes and tax credit bond financing and these other examples that are listed here. So we're bringing to them the question, are some of these examples the type of assessment tax or fee that you might support? And which of the above should get further consideration? General criteria would you apply to determine the acceptability of a new revenue source? Are there any analyses or position statements that they'd like to produce for us or share with us in our consideration of these various options? I got to save that one for a minute. But basically, we surveyed these organizations. We're having follow-up discussions with them. We're trying to work with these other interest groups to determine whether there's a consensus around raising a new pot of money or multiple pots of money to invest in elements of this system. Two or three things that will accomplish, and it goes back to the trifecta. If we can succeed in finding this investment capital, we can achieve the objective of making our businesses more globally competitive because of the forces we talked about earlier. That is becoming more and more essential. Obviously, the stress that is being felt by transportation departments across the nation, the strain on gas tax revenues being caused by the high prices, our revenues are down. Federal Highway Trust revenues are going down. We are going to be facing a very difficult time in maintaining the highway and bridge system we have today, and the highway and bridge system we have today isn't adequate. So there's going to be a significant challenge there. So the extent to which we can utilize the capacity of these other systems becomes critically important to preserve the highway and bridge systems that we have already. And the third item, obviously, is the climate change debate and the policies that are going to arise that are going to affect the transportation programs of the future. And my last slide suggests that when you have these polar political opposites in at least agreeing that global warming isn't a hoax, I think they both don't necessarily share the level of urgency associated with global warming. But there has been a basic acceptance that the problem is real. Certainly, Senator McCain and Barack Obama may be approaching it differently, but both agree climate change is a serious issue. So clearly, it's going to be a significant policy influence on the transportation sector, and how we move freight and goods in this country is going to be a significant component of the next authorization conversation. And these are some of the ideas, policy discussions, and initiatives that are going on around the country to address that particular element of our transportation policy discussion. And with that, I thank you for your kind attention and look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you, Greg. We do have a number of questions in here that we'll get to after this final presentation, which is going to be given by Sarah Flagg of the Port of Seattle. Sarah, when you're ready, you can begin.
Hi. I'm on the West Coast, so it is still morning for me. So good morning for those of you on my side of the continent. My name is Sarah Flagg. I am an environmental management specialist at the Port of Seattle in the Seaport Environmental Program. My primary focus here is working on looking at the goods movement chain and trying to address both efficiencies and reducing emissions from everything related to transport of goods, ocean-going vessels, cargo handling equipment, trucks, rails, harbor vessels that moves on the waterfront, try to reduce emissions from it. To give you a quick overview of the Port of Seattle, get an understanding of who we are and what we do. We're an independent municipal corporation that was created in 1911. I think this is particularly important that we are a government agency, but we are not part of the city, we are not part of the state. We are responsible to the voters of King County who elect our five-member commission. We also have we're one of the only ports in the United States that has as diverse of operations as we do. We operate the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, which is the major airport in the Pacific Northwest region for Washington. We have commercial real estate, including World Trade Center in Seattle, and we also have the seaport, which is extremely diverse for a seaport. We have container operations, we have one break bulk facility, which is a grain terminal, and we have four marinas. We also have 19 parks and public access sites. One of our main reasons for being was to preserve public access to the waterfront. We have a broad economic impact to the region. The port itself employs about 1,700 people, but all of the facilities that we own and lease to terminal operators or other companies supports nearly 200,000 jobs in the Puget Sound region. And we give back just over $600 million in state and local taxes. So we're a significant economic generator in this region. Not quite Microsoft, but, you know, we try. This is a visual map of where we're located in the Seattle area. I think this is important to note that downtown Seattle is right here. Familiar with the Space Needle, it's right here. And all of the colored areas are our different facilities that we own. The yellow ones are our container terminals. And then we do have two cruise facilities, one in the South Harbor and one almost smack in the middle of downtown. We're also extremely close to our intermodal facilities. We have the Union Pacific Rail Yard and the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Rail Yard, almost adjacent to our terminals. The typical length of travel time between our terminals is less a mile or less, which is extremely unique. We are a very space-constrained city. On the east side of us is Lake Washington, so not a lot of room. And wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, how we try to strike the balance. How we try here at the Port of Seattle to really be a good steward of the environment and balance port competitiveness. One thing I should mention is the Port of Seattle is what is called a discretionary port. By discretionary, I mean 70% of what is transported through our port goes out of the region, 30% is consumed here. There's about 6 million people in Washington State, so not a large population. In contrast, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, about 70% is consumed in that area of what goes through there. We have volumes of about 2 million 20-foot equivalent units, or TEUs, come through our port. This is contrast that to LA and Long Beach again, where they have 15 million. So it really does affect kind of the dynamics that go into our environmental program. About a year ago, we had a new CEO, Teo Shitani, come on board, and his goal is for the Port of Seattle to be the cleanest, greenest, and most energy efficient port in the U.S., which is a tall order, but is one that I think we're on a solid foundation getting to. We do have on our terminal facilities that I showed you, most of that land is filled in tidal marsh. It's at the mouth of the Duwamish River, and Seattle historically did not have a lot of flat land. It's a very hilly area, and the early settlers filled it in to get some flat industrial land. And over the years that land has been used as creosote factories, as shipbuilding areas during World War II. Boeing is located there, so any property that the port buys, we always clean up. We've bought a lot of Superfund sites over the years and made sure to clean them up, be good stewards of the land, and also provide public access and habitat. So it is an industrial area, and we have a lot of growth and goods movement. I know right now with the way the economy is, not as much as what was predicted, but we've still seen significant growth over the past few years. And as we are a space-constrained port, more growth is always challenging. And we're always concerned about impacts of public health and the environment. We are very close to downtown Seattle, a large population center, and we know that diesel particulate matter from equipment operating in and around our terminals does have public health impacts. Trying to seek to create a level playing field and at the same time using environmental stewardship as the port's competitive edge. I'll get into the level playing field a little bit more towards the end of the presentation, but one of the things that we don't want to do is create a situation where it is so much more expensive to come through to the Port of Seattle that it is not attractive to shippers. We want to create a situation where they both are able to do the right thing environmentally and still move freight. Why is air quality important to the Port of Seattle? I've touched on a few of these things already. I will mention that we, in the Puget Sound region, if you're not familiar with it, we are very close to Canada, British Columbia. At 100 or so miles to the north of us is Port Metro Vancouver, which is the largest port on the Canadian west coast. And about 25 or 30 miles to the south of us is Port of Tacoma. Those ports are the same size as Port of Seattle, and we all share the same airshed, so we work together. Our Seaport Air Quality Program has been founded on being collaborative and voluntary. The Puget Sound region is still in attainment for all of the national ambient air quality standards, and we want to keep it that way. Because we don't have the same kind of regulatory drivers that other ports have around the United States or elsewhere, we really needed to look for a way that we could get ahead of the game, maintain our good air quality, and still be economically viable. One of the first things that we needed to understand was what our contribution was in terms of pollutants. And so we came together to conduct the Puget Sound Maritime Air Emissions Inventory. And my next slide, we'll talk about that a little bit more. We also really try to focus on both emission reduction and goods movement efficiencies at the same time, reducing fuel consumption, increasing productivity, moving more with less. In contrast to the Southern California ports, I know I keep contrasting that, but for us on the West Coast, it's kind of important. The theirs has been a very top-down mandated approach. They are in severe non-attainment for national ambient air quality standards. They have had a different set of regulatory drivers, a different set of community concerns than we have, and we have been lucky to have the flexibility to take the collaborative voluntary approach that we've been able to. The Puget Sound Maritime Air Emissions Inventory, as I mentioned, is a 2005 activity-based inventory of all maritime-related operations in the Puget Sound. This is important because it is the first maritime air emissions inventory that was voluntarily conducted that didn't just look at what was happening at a port. Our region is heavily maritime. We're a big inland sea. Lots of stuff crosses the water. We have two major ports in Puget Sound, Port of Seattle and Port of Tacoma, and we have a lot of little ports, Olympia, Everett, Bellingham. All of them have activity. Everett's very very active in moving Boeing parts. So we wanted to make sure that we were having an accurate picture of everything that was happening, not just what was happening at our terminals in our boundaries. We also have a lot of oil refineries. We included that as well. So this span is essentially everything from the U.S.-Canada border south and then out to the red lines east and west. This was coordinated with a similar effort that was going on in Canada and for the Georgia Basin side of the airshed. And we were the first to include greenhouse gases, which is something that we wanted to include because we knew it would be information that we would need. And when we published this in April of 2007, kind of congratulated ourselves on our foresight, because shortly after that was when the debate on greenhouse gases really started to take off. To give you an idea of kind of our findings, we're really focused on two pollutants in this region, diesel particulate matter, because of the public health impacts, and greenhouse gases. So this is for the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency region. Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is our local air regulatory agency, and they are responsible for the central Puget Sound region, where the majority of the populations are. This is the breakdown of what segments of the goods movement chain contributed what amounts to diesel particulate matter emissions in the area. About 29% of everything, so that's what's happening at the ports. It's our Washington State ferries, it's passenger ferries, besides just Washington State, excursion vessels, pleasure boats, name it, it's in there. We also wanted to break down ocean-going vessels because of the fact that your different solutions are different based on what mode of transit the vessels are in. Heavy-duty vehicles is just what is port-related. So there's a lot of other freight that's happening in the region, but we wanted to know what it was that was coming and going to marine terminals. And that was about 1% of the emissions. We estimated that 3% of all the heavy-duty vehicle traffic in the Puget Sound region was port-related, so coming and going from marine terminals. In the meantime, we've had a lot of emission reduction projects. Some of the cargo projects are to use biodiesel blends in our cargo handling equipment, retrofits with diesel oxidation catalysts, again, focusing on efficiencies and gate improvements. Rail grade separations have been a big thing here as well, and looking for technologies such as radio frequency identification to get the cargo flowing faster through the terminals. Tried to put things, convert things from diesel to electric when possible. We're lucky here in the Pacific Northwest that we have hydropower, so it's a relatively clean source of energy. Cruise projects, we do have shore power at our Terminal 30 cruise facility for two vessels. The only berth in the world that is able to plug in two vessels at the same time. And these were projects that were initiated by Princess Cruises and Holland America Line. So they each have four calls here per week during our cruise season, which runs from April to October. And they're able to plug into the city grid using low sulfur fuels and piloting a seawater scrubber for the engine back on one of the Holland America Line vessels. What we've been working on in the last year is the Northwest Ports Clean Air Strategy. This is kind of getting at the creating a level playing field, understanding that we are in the, we share an airshed with Port Metro Vancouver and Port of Tacoma, and wanting to not compete on environmental issues. Our CEO would like to use our environmental stewardship as our competitive edge, but at the same time, we don't want to be competing with our sister ports to the north and to the south of us for business based on the environment. So our objective here is to create a voluntary and joint strategy to reduce port-related emissions that affect air quality and climate change in the Pacific Northwest, or Puget Sound, Georgia Basin Airshed. It sounds very simple. Actually extremely complex. You have two countries, three ports, and a whole host of stakeholders and different federal regulatory agencies. And we've worked very closely with our agencies on this. US EPA, Environment Canada, Washington Department of Ecology, and Puget Sound Clean Air Agency have been great partners in creating this. It was adopted by the Port of Seattle Commission in January of this year, as well as Port of Tacoma Commission. Port Metro Vancouver is, you may hear me kind of messing their name up since they just became Port Metro Vancouver a few days ago. They've been in the process of amalgamating all of the little ports in that area into authority, so they are lagging behind us a little bit in adoption, but not in the work. As I mentioned, we have been very collaborative in our process. This is just a sampling of the partners that we've worked with, everyone from state and local agencies, federal agencies, industry, nonprofit organizations such as American Lung Association. We really feel like this is an important approach for us because of the fact that we are trying to do things so proactively and voluntarily and get the industry buy-in and do things that allow the industry to have more efficient operations here. Our strategy approach is to have clear, measurable performance measures for each of the source categories, what we call the different segments of the goods movement chain, and to really encourage innovation instead of mandated solutions. Set the target, don't set the way to get there. With short-term and long-term targets, short-term is 2010, long-term is 2015. This is a matrix of our performance measures. It's very simplified from what's actually in the report. For trucks, we are looking at finding a way to increase the age of the trucks that call to the Port of Seattle to 1994. Right now, our average age of trucks that call to the Port of Seattle is 1996. We have about 400 trucks that are older than 94. And then by 2015, we would like 80% of the trucks to meet a 2007 standard. The reason why we set those targets was because, again, we're looking at particulate matter. For rail, we've been working with Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe on expediting their EPA SmartWay commitments and looking what we can do related to fuels in their switching operations and intermodal yard operations. Stakeholder consultation and outreach has been a huge part of this effort. We really developed this in conjunction with our industry and community stakeholders. We developed stakeholder work groups for each of the different industry segments, working with the truckers, working with the shippers, working with carriers, working with the terminal operators. We did also have an environmental group where we worked with the nonprofit organizations. And we had a couple of public meetings and public comment periods so that we could take into account community concerns. And I will point out that the stakeholder process is still very much underway. We may have created the strategy, but we still have to create the implementation program, which is much, much more difficult than just creating the document, which took us a year to do. Again, working with the industry is a collaborative bottom-up approach instead of top-down mandated, and looking for emission reductions goods movement efficiencies, in lockstep with Port of Tacoma, Port Metro Vancouver, and I've really covered this already, and building on what works at the Port of Seattle, one of the things that we have heard universally is don't recreate the wheel. Use what we already have, or build on what we've already have here, and so that it's much easier for people to implement, and it's not a huge headache that discourages participation. Strategy implementation, like I said, we're working on the implementation plans now, continuing to work with stakeholders, balancing environmental and business needs, and really we need to start securing funding. None of this gets done without funding somehow. So we're looking at all of those options right now. And some of the business considerations that we have during this whole process is, you know, what are the impacts to efficient goods movement? We don't want to do anything that's going to shut down the port or create bottlenecks or, you know, say that you have to have trucks that are a certain age and nobody can meet that, and then there's no trucks to move containers off of the terminals. And environmental and community considerations, does this support our goal for public health? And are we still attaining the national ambient air quality standards? So we still have a lot of work to do, but a good solid foundation to do it on. And with that, here's my contact information, and I look forward to any questions.
Well, thank